Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Lowy Institute. My name is Alex Oliver. I'm the Director of Research at the Lowy Institute. It's on, it's off, it's on again. The events of the past few months, including this event, in fact, with the United States and North Korea negotiations have redefined the meaning of roller coaster. It's been a Donald Trump classic. Theatrics, tweets with lots of capitalizations, unpredictable twists and turns. But it's anything but a laughing matter. In the last 2 years, the North Korea regime has apparently pulled off what was previously unthinkable, the development of a long-range missile capability designed to carry miniaturized nuclear warheads. To provide some answers about where this Trump-Kim melodrama will end, I have on stage two extremely qualified experts with me. Firstly, on my left, Ewan Graham, my colleague, has been the director of the International Security Program at the Institute for the last 3 years. He came to us from the S. Rajaratnam School of International Studies in Singapore, where he specialised in maritime issues, and before that he was a research analyst in the UK Foreign and Commonwealth Office. But he's also one of a very rare and select group of individuals who has actually been a diplomat in North Korea, having been chargé d'affaires at the British Embassy in Pyongyang. The Lowy Institute has just released a new analysis by Ewan called Trump, Kim and the North Korean Nuclear Missile Melodrama, and you can feel free to take one today. It takes an in-depth look at what is happening when Pyongyang's brand of brinkmanship meets the fast-moving political theatre of Donald Trump and those two very volatile universes collide. It certainly has made for an interesting editing process. Ewan argues that North Korea cannot be explained without also understanding the relationship with North and South Korea. And then there is China, and that leads me to our next panellist, Bates Gill, who is an internationally respected China specialist. He's a professor of security studies at Macquarie University and has previously held academic positions at the ANU and the University of Sydney. He was a director at SIPRI, the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, for 5 years until 2012, and he's also been a senior fellow at Brookings Institution. So welcome to you both, and thank you. Ewan, since your analysis paper was released last week, the summit between Trump and Kim was cancelled, and then it was uncancelled, and it's probably safe to say the drama isn't over yet. There was a bit of debate about what Donald Trump was up to with his strangely worded letter, which he apparently clearly dictated himself. Was he simply applying his skills developed on real estate negotiations? Do you think it worked? And what do you think are the odds that the summit will actually go ahead on June the 12th?
Well, it worked in the sense that up until that point, the North Koreans had been giving clear signals that they were reconsidering whether to participate in the talks. There was a rather angry reaction to Vice President Pence's comments, particularly in relation to his raising of the so-called Libya model. That was very smartly followed by a total change. In North Korean terms, the most placatory statement that I can remember from the senior vice foreign minister, the lead negotiator with the US, Kim Gae-gwan, which was full of sort of, you know, emollient language, which was a pretty sharp turnaround. So in that sense, tactically, I think declaring a willingness to walk away from the negotiation, maybe it takes a showman to know a showman. There might be an element of that. But I think the question behind your question is who has agency in this whole melodrama? Is it Donald Trump who's dictating the script? Well, that might be one small part of an act in which I think he did play a role, and maybe not an unuseful role. But depending on where you stand, I've heard people saying, well, that this is actually orchestrated by China in the background. South Korea is the one that's intervened. Moon Jae-in is the one who's rescued us from a path to war and put us on the pathway to a summit process. But I think sitting at the center of this, clearly there's one actor who stands above the others, Kim Jong-un. And for my money, I think the script is fundamentally a variation on the North Korean preferences. And that flip around that we've seen from confrontation right up until the end of 2017, test after test after test after test, and then suddenly turning that around into a full-blown outreach mode, hadn't travelled overseas at all as leader in 6 years, and then suddenly within succession he's been to China twice, he's had two summits with the South Korean leader, and then the big prize, the US, the first time the North Korean leader has ever met a serving US president. And I think that the agency fundamentally lies with North Korea.
You mentioned the role of Pence and I presume Bolton in that sort of Libya model discussion, which seems to have riled up Kim. Bates, you mentioned earlier when we were talking about the role of China in sort of ramping up Korea's sort of assertiveness and aggressiveness in these negotiations about the summit. What role does China play here? What is it doing in preparation for this summit? What does it expect, or what does it want? What does it want to be resolved on the peninsula?
Well, I think in all the midst of all the theatrics and the melodrama and so forth, all too often lost is what I believe to be the absolute centrality of China's role here. I think it would be extremely difficult to get to an endpoint that most of us in this room would consider positive without China, at a minimum, acquiescing to it. And I think probably preferably for Beijing, without China having a significant role in shaping whatever that positive outcome is that we can all agree to. So I don't think we should lose sight of that. My sense is, at least in trying to follow how the Trump administration is approaching this, is that they have lost sight of that, or at least to the degree that China might be considered a factor here, it's in this very transactional way. You know, we'll trade away the trade sanctions to make sure that you're still on board as we proceed with our effort with the North. I think it's a big mistake. Because just on the basis of proximity, history, and maybe most importantly, fundamental national interests of China, they are not going to let a situation unfold there which is contrary to their interests. And their interests, I think, are relatively easy to understand. First of all, stability. Second of all, no way can the United States act in a way that's going to expand its power and presence on the Korean Peninsula, and preferably for Beijing, a diminution of American presence is where they would like to see it all go in one way or another. And yes, third on that list, a denuclearized or at least significantly less overt nuclear capability on the part of the North Koreans. So I guess I would just say that as we go towards this bilateral summit with the United States, if and as it occurs, I think Xi Jinping might be a little nervous about where it's going to go. And that may well explain why they did have that second meeting in Dalian. And if this gets postponed to some other date, like September or something like that, I think we'll see Xi Jinping and Kim Jong-un sitting down again to make sure that China's message is delivered to what they want to see the outcomes with coming out of the Trump-Kim summit.
Ewan, how do we get to this point where we were looking at multiple nuclear tests and missiles over Japan and towards Guam, and we were seemed rapidly towards conflict, and in fact that was even the rhetoric on the US side. What turned this around? Why have we now turned to dialogue? You talked about agency. What about motivations?
Well, here again, I think it's not a significant departure from the North Korean playbook. It's happened a lot faster than happened under Kim Jong-il or Kim Il-sung. But stopping at the brink is the classic modus operandi. And where North Korea has chosen to stop is right at the cusp of an operational ICBM capability. That's the end goal that everyone has assumed that North Koreans are working towards for decades. And From a negotiating position, maybe Mr. Trump would look at it this way, which is it's going out and testing at peak value what that program is worth. Not that there's a second question that whether those intentions are actually in good faith or not, but it would be perfectly consistent with the way that North Korea has always gone about business, which is to use the nuclear card as part deterrent but part negotiating gambit. And I think that that's part of what's happening now, is that the timing, again, we got to the point where that operational test took place of three ICBM missiles, but particularly the last one on the 29th of November last year was the one that probably had the legs to reach the east coast of the United States. Now, it was on a lofted trajectory. It wasn't tested to the same degree of rigor that the United States or the Soviet Union would have done. But nonetheless, it's probably good enough for North Korea's purposes to put sufficient doubt in the US's mind. And the US intelligence assessment, such as we are led to believe from what's leaked out, is pretty much on the same page that North Korea is very at that, right at the end point of that that long holy grail of a nuclear-tipped missile.
Does the United States overestimate the power of North Korea? We released a couple of weeks ago our inaugural Asia Power Index, which is a pretty amazing tool if you want to go online and have a look at it, where we measured the power of 25 countries in Asia, including the United States as a major player in Asia. And the US comes first in 5 out of the 8 categories. China comes first in the other 3. And so the two of them are neck and neck. North Korea surprisingly fell way out of even the top 10. And we did wonder, you know, why it was so low down in the power rankings when it appears to have used its power to maximum effect. Given that its only strength, and the Power Index identified where its strengths were, and it really only has that one strength, which is in its nuclear capability, and to a certain extent its armed forces on the ground. And the only way you can exercise that power is actually to assure its own self-destruction. Does the US overestimate its power? Is it making a mistake there?
Let me query that point, whether it's only usable in a sense that it leads to self-destruction. There are other ways that nuclear weapons can be used without employing them, just by virtue of their existence. They cast a strategic influence that's outsized to any other military capability, which is why, of course, we have states that have acquired nuclear weapons. The permanent 5 members of the UN Security Council are all nuclear powers, not by coincidence. One way in which North Korea may seek to use that influence is this thesis of a so-called decoupling risk, that by putting United States in direct threat in the range of its long-range missiles, that the US nuclear credit guarantee to South Korea and Japan will be much less credible, because Washington in the final analysis won't trade Los Angeles for Seoul. So I think the nuclear weapons can only be, they're useless because they can never be employed except for a train of events that will lead to suicide. I think that needs to be questioned a little bit. But you're absolutely right to flag the point that North Korea really only has one strength. It's put all of the eggs in one basket. And that's been very successful at getting it to a table with US president. We wouldn't have had any of this high-level attention. North Korea would be, it has an economy the size of Gabon and would probably be treated with equivalent strategic attention were it not for the nuclear capability that it wields. But then the ultimate question is, so what will North Korea be able to parlay that into if it has a successful outcome? And this is the point I get into in my paper, which is fundamentally North Korea is a highly weak, brittle state, because the comparison with South Korea leaves it totally behind in terms of economic legitimacy, democratic legitimacy, you name it. South Korea has a purchasing power per capita income 22 times that of the North. It's not going to make that gap up. The only way it can is to wave this big Trump card. But to what end? Is it to an opening of to welcoming investment? This is, I think, maybe a mistake that the Trump administration has made in assuming that North Korea wants this great influx of capital and freedom of movement and freedom of information. But from the Korean regime's point of view, North Korean regime's point of view, once you do that, once you open up, then that's game over, probably, because most of those North Korean citizens are going to choose to live in one Korea, and it's not going to be the North that they choose.
I just add, if I could, to that, Alex. Of course, the way the report was structured, it probably doesn't disaggregate, you know, power in a way that is only looking at a very narrow set of sort of relationships. But, you know, on the Korean Peninsula itself, yes, it's probably true that, I mean, it is true that South Korea is by far the more powerful country, and I'm sure that's what your data demonstrated. But in the context of a potential conflict on the peninsula, the numbers for North Korea presumably would rise up
considerably. Military power was, in fact, fifth.
Rise up considerably. So that's, in that context, it's pretty strong. And I guess just to get back to the China question as well, to what degree... It's not really measurable, but you know the degree to which countries have powerful friends could also be factored into a nation's power index, I suppose. And again, that gets us back to where China is and where China is in relation to its support for North Korea would, I think, be a pretty important factor.
Mm. Yes, defense relationships and networks were factored in, but you're absolutely right. But talking about this, it's one power being nuclear, then what are the genuine prospects for denuclearization of the peninsula, do you think?
Well, I think this is a phrase that we all need to unpack pretty carefully, and I think UN might be in the best position to look at that. In that very pleasant response, which Kim issued in response to the Trump letter, he comes out looking like a statesman by saying that it is his hope an expectation that these conversations can lead to the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. What does that mean? What does that mean when Kim says such a thing? I don't think we will know until we get into the negotiations, but I think, in my view, it probably does not mean that North Korea would give up the capacity to have nuclear weapons. It probably means, in Kim's mind, some sort of a significant reduction or even removal of the possibility that nuclear weapons would be used on the Korean Peninsula. But I don't think it means that the North Korean regime would give up its capacity to have them. Maybe it would be some sort of recessed type deterrent, you know, a la Israel or something like that, but not openly wielded, you know, at Japan or at South Korea or at the United States or anyone else. That's what I suspect he means by denuclearization. What are the prospects for that? Well, that's the big question, isn't it? Because if President Trump in the United States means complete, verifiable denuclearization, then this negotiation isn't going to get very far, at least not in the near term. I mean, even presuming that that is what Kim means, and that there he is prepared to go down the pathway of a verifiable disarmament and denuclearization, this is not Iraq. I mean, Iraq had not even gone anywhere close. This is not Libya. This is a country that already has a significant nuclear capability. And trying to track all that down and walk it all back verifiably and undeniably is going to take at least a decade, at least. Long after Donald Trump is a thing of the past. So I think that is a real disconnect, because if that's where President Trump intends to go, at least at the moment, I don't think it's where Kim intends to go. How do you define denuclearization when he says that?
Maybe let's approach it from the U.S. angle first. We have an administration that's dedicated to an America-first foreign policy, so logically, the uppermost threat, as Secretary of State Pompeo has said, is to the homeland. And what the United States is most seized about is tackling that direct threat. So denuclearization perhaps could be led in that vein to removing the long-range missiles that would gain direct nuclear threat to the United States. And that might be something that that Kim's prepared to look at. It wouldn't mean wholesale denuclearization. But maybe for the United States, the short-term imperative is not full denuclearization. The rub is really going to be saying to the American people that that threat has been defanged. Therefore, the primary priority in that, at least in the short term, I suspect, will be removing the long-range missile threat. And Kim, maybe, because precisely as Bates has said, he's built up enough nuclear collateral now that he can afford to trade some of it away and not lose his nuclear deterrent. Let's not forget, North Korea has not been attacked by the United States since the Korean War, and it's engaged in multiple acts of provocation that resulted in military fatalities. Even without nuclear weapons, President Nixon faced this quandary 50 years ago when the USS Pueblo was taken. He wanted to retaliate, but was then told by his chief of staff there was no good option for that. So we're seeing the same echoes sort of all through history. Dealing with North Korea is the land of no good options. And in that sense, maybe the imperfect one, the expedient that the United States wants to deal with is the long-range threat. But take it back to the ledger on the North Korean side. While this process is going on of a long, decade-long arms control process, and I use arms control process rather than unilateral disarmament, because I think what the North Koreans want to do is gain the status out of that prolonged peer-to-peer relationship. This is something, arms control only operates between declared nuclear superpowers historically. It's only between Russia and the United States. So if North Korea is on that pedestal for that duration of time, it gains that legitimacy that it can't do by any other means. And I think spinning out that process as long as possible has a political gain in that sense.
It was quite intriguing to see President Moon and Kim Jong-il meet again yesterday. It seemed unexpected. Nobody seemed to know about it until a couple of hours after it was over. Sort of prompted me to think, what would happen? To what extent can South Korea kind of take matters into its own hands? Do you think it has? And you know, where do its interests differ and align with those of the United States in these discussions?
Well, I think from the broader sweep of history, if we look at what's happened in recent weeks, one very good thing is this volatility in a way. We never saw this flexibility from North Korea in the past to be able to get on a plane. Kim Jong-il always traveled by train. Now Kim Jong-un flies and he gets a car at 24 hours notice and has an impromptu meeting with the South Korean president for the second time in a month. What I heard is that the request for that meeting actually came from Kim, not from Moon. So that maybe tells you something again about the agency issue. But I think President Moon is in a familiar position for South Korean presidents of not really being able to dictate their own fate to the extent that they would want, because precisely North Korea will do everything rather than deal with South Korea on level terms. It wants to bring the United States in. It will talk to China. When North Korea talks to South Korea, it's also doing so as a stepping stone to get to the United States. I think Moon understands this. I mean, he's been there. He's been there before. He was the chief of staff to the previous president, who did the last summit back in 2007. And so he's no fool, I think, on North Korea. And we shouldn't paint him as naive as some of the caricatures have done. But he is ultimately limited by Kim Jong-un's willingness to engage on level terms with South Korea. And I think let's see what happens. He may agree to take more financial aid, more economic projects in future. And I think he'll certainly try and lead South Korea over the red line of sanctions as a way of forcing a fissure between the United States and its ally. But ultimately, I don't think President Moon is going to be able to carry this forward once the opportunity is there for Kim Jong-un to meet Donald Trump. That's the grand prize for North Korea. And I think South Korea will only be engaged as long as it's useful. Again, national interest is the lens through which to view the actions.
I think I might just add one point there, just to make sure we get it on the table today, and that's the degree to which Kim's strategy, in part, includes precisely the intention of putting fissures in between the United States and South Korea. I understood that, as impromptu as this meeting was with Kim and Moon over the weekend, President Moon did not inform his American allies that this was going to take place, and that it came as a surprise to Washington. Maybe that's understandable given what sort of reactions could have arisen from a Twitter storm of one kind or another. But nevertheless, it's an interesting example of precisely, I would think, one of the aims of all of this diplomacy on Kim's part, and I might add, and his Chinese supporters, which is to a part of this entire process, in their view, needs to involve ultimately a diminution of the American presence, and ideally even the end of the alliance between the United States and South Korea. And right now, the way things are unfolding, I think Kim's gaining some steps in that direction.
So even though he's taken that off the table and said he's not going to demand any sort of U.S. drawdown in South Korea, you think that's still the end game?
It's part of the end game. I mean, you could envision a situation in which the entire negotiation between the United States and North Korea collapses, but that there is still an effort underway between the two Koreas to try and move the process forward. And in that process, undermining the credibility of the alliance increasingly seen as an obstacle to that outcome. So it's a part. It's I don't know how central it is to his overall strategy. I think you're right. It's probably status and legitimacy is what is most coveted. But a part of the approach, I think, is going to try and deal away, try and see if you can deal with the Americans in a way that removes their threat and ultimately even the alliance.
But maybe the wild card possibility, and I mentioned it's only a wild card possibility, is that the North Koreans are geopolitically balancing here. That the way of baiting the United States into the equation is to present itself as the threat, but the threat can then be traded as a means of normalizing the relationship with the United States, because Kim, more than any of his predecessors, has inherited an economy that's more enthralled to China than 90% of trade goes through China. Kim didn't travel as his father had done to Beijing until very recently. There's no love lost between China and North Korea. From a Chinese perspective, North Korea is a kind of useful bully that does a lot of the dirty work that it doesn't have to in terms of splintering the alliances. And China is, as Bates has alluded to, I think a very important strategic shadow that gives it a kind of extended deterrence, nuclear or otherwise. Just sharing that border puts a lot of pause into US and other minds in terms of taking on North Korea. But I think that's an intriguing possibility, whether this drawing the United States into a summit is actually, in a sense, in earnest, to try and change that relationship and to bring the United States in as a balance, not only to South Korea, but also to the big country across the northern border. Mm.
What else does North Korea want? Just as a sort of final question before we go to questions. What does it want vis-a-vis South Korea? Is it looking for unification on its own terms? Is it obviously looking for a peace treaty? It's looking for removal of sanctions. What's its goal with this summit? What is it going to try and wreak out of the negotiations?
Status is important. I think the being treated as a nuclear peer, declaring itself as a nuclear state, we've already seen very clear signalling on North Korea's part that that's the way it intends to come into this negotiation from a position of strength, from a position of confidence. It wants the United States to wind back sanctions, no question. It would like not necessarily access to US finance. I don't think that's going to be on the table, but rather the way that the US acts as the conduit to international financing from the IFIs, the financial institutions, having a normalized relationship with the United States would take all that away. The peace treaty will also, it will recast relations with the South Korean alliance. If you have a peace treaty, why does South Korea need United States forces on the peninsula? It will make it much easier then to sort of chip away at that logic from the North Korean position. But what I think Kim Jong-un wants and what he's able to do maybe are different things. It's possible Western-trained, and we saw him greeting the South Korean president with a Swiss-style kiss on three cheeks yesterday, which was, I think, a sign that, you know, he's not from the old mold of Kim Il-sung. Maybe he wants to do something different, but his ability to do that is going to be checked for this fundamental reason that if you open the lid to freedom of movement and freedom of information, the enemy will not be from without, the enemy will be from within. And that's ultimately, I think, the prism through which a regime views, a regime like, totalitarian regime like North Korea views its security.
Well, thank you both. We've got now a good 25 minutes for Q&A. Charlie?
Ewan helpfully pointed out that North Korea would not necessarily be amenable to the idea of a permanently divided Korean peninsula. However, since the end of the Korean War, there has been a rather inert peace between North and South Korea, and the North Korean regime has continued to exist. Would there be any scenario, in your view, that in which Kim Jong-un would agree to a permanently divided Korean peninsula?
I think it's extremely difficult because it's virtually hardwired into North Korean thinking that the division of the peninsula is the fault of outside countries who've been meddling. Therefore, to sort of officially enshrine the division of the peninsula would be a hard sell. Perhaps if the South Koreans were to do one thing that could give security assurances, and these are security assurances are very much sort of in the debate at the moment, what they would mean in practical terms to North Korea. One thing that isn't mentioned, surprisingly, is that South Korea has a claim on the whole peninsula. It's written into the constitution as the territory is defined as the entire peninsula. If the South Koreans were prepared to roll that back, they would no longer have a Ministry of Unification. Maybe they would just deal with North Korea as a regular diplomatic relationship. In that sense, if you remove the claim, maybe that would assuage some of the fears, understandable, in North Korea that it would be subsumed within a process of unification on South Korea's terms. But let's not deny North Korea's ambition or its not take it at its own word. It wants unification on its own terms. Very hard to see how that could happen without a military conquest of South Korea, and even that would be fraught. The military is strong, as Bates says, but in a conventional invasion scenario, it would pretty quickly, I think, lead to a defeat. North Korea is still wedded to that narrative of reunification just as much as South Korea is wedded to that narrative of reunification. And I think that's part of the existential problem two Koreas have in dealing with each other. Even though they're both recognized as sovereign states within the UN system, it's the inequity of the comparison that disadvantages the North. So if they can get the US off South Korea, if President Trump, looking for a big thing to declare, says that the Korean War is over, then that will certainly, I think, be a major fillip for North Korea's propaganda campaign in the comparison with South Korea. But ultimately, I think that's the real threat that it faces, much more than the external bogeyman of the United States.
Bates, is a divided Korea in China's interests?
Yes, I think in the near term it probably is. I think the Chinese could live with a unified Korea, but not at any price, and obviously unified in a way that is consistent with China's interests. So I think until that correlation of circumstances arises, and I don't see that coming anytime soon, not least because of the problems that Ewan just explained that on the Korean Peninsula itself, a preferred option then would be continued division. And it has its problems. I mean, it obviously creates tensions and difficulties that China would prefer weren't there. A significant American military presence. We had all the business most recently with China's concerns about the deployment of THAAD anti-missile batteries that China claims, you know, could undermine its own nuclear deterrent. You have in the North, you know, a volatile, unpredictable leader who, up until recently at least, I think was a bit of a thorn in the side of the Chinese leadership. But all of that, as troublesome as it is better, I think, in the Chinese point of view, than a unified Korea that unfolds in a way that is entirely on, say, South Korean or even, say, US/South Korean terms, which would then potentially allow for the expansion of the American presence there, right up against Chinese borders, etc. So that's not something they want to see. So for the time being, division seems to work in spite of all the problems it has for Beijing.
Richard.
One thing you touched upon, I wonder whether it's a bit of the sleeper at the moment, that is North Korean economic reform. Xi Jinping spoke to, I mean, as you know, the Chinese have been urging the North Koreans to do this for decades. Ewan, I think you said that if Korea worried, they'd just be subsumed or the regime would collapse, the leadership would collapse if that happened. But maybe Kim Jong-un thinks that he's got 40, 50 more years in office. He can't sort of last as sort of a god king stroke criminal despot for that amount of time. And he might in fact be able to strengthen his position compared to South Korea if he had a bit, if he had a stronger economy.
So Kim Jong-un has already parted ways with the slogan of military first, which was his father's watchword. Byung-jin is now the slogan, and that translates roughly to mean military but economic development as well. That's the first time that economic development has been raised that high as a state objective. But fundamentally, I think the prism, as I said, that the regime looks through is that of regime security. Economic development is fine as a means to an end, and if it helps raise the standard of living so that popularity of Kim Jong-un will increase, then all fair and well. But not to the point, I think, at which you start to get the more dangerous socioeconomic interactions. And of course, all communist countries have faced the same issue. The question then is, why can't North Korea do a Vietnam, or why can't it be like China itself? And I think here again, it fundamentally comes back to the unresolved reunification question. The reason North Korea maintains a blockade on information is because it wants to deny this open comparison on the part of ordinary people. That the more free interactions that you get between South Koreans and North Koreans, that will inevitably spell trouble. So I think the maximum that he will do with the South Koreans is to reinstate the kind of zoned projects that we had up until 2013, the Kaesong project, the Kumgang project, maybe a few more that the South Koreans, I think, would only be willing to underwrite. But within a kind of gated compound, walled off from the undesirable socioeconomic impacts that those generate. And that's why throughout
these experiments that we've often seen, North Korea's leadership are not stupid. They know fully well how that they've that economically they are prostrate compared to their South Korean counterparts, but they're unable to move beyond that cycle. They experiment for a while and then the lid comes down, and we sort of move in that fitful one step forward, you know, two steps back. And I just don't see how they get out of that unless something really radical happens, like I said, on the South Korean side, where they declare that they have no claim over the territory of the North.
Daniel Rolland, Sydney University. I'm curious about one thing. Russia shares a border with North Korea. Is Russia irrelevant to everything we've been talking about, looking back and looking forward?
I'll take a quick stab at that. I mean, we haven't talked about it. I think that that itself reflects that Russia is a... It has a border, so obviously that gives it an equity that can't be discounted, but it's not a major player in the Korean drama. It has a cameo role, usually in the sort of seat at the table slash spoiler mode, and alternates between both of those. And I think it saw some advantage in the tensions between China and North Korea, as China was, in relative terms, putting on a harder economic squeeze than we've seen before. And lo and behold, it turned out that some of the oil that was making its way into North Korea was doing so from Russia, both directly and also via at-sea transfers. But I think that's these aren't really strategic influences. Although Lavrov is supposed to go in and visit soon, I think that the Russians would like to use North Korea as far as possible, perhaps as collateral in their relationship with the United States. They look at how that's worked well for China, but they're not fundamentally going to be the deciders of the outcome.
Michael Aaron, sir, I'm just interested in your take on the US president going to a meeting in Singapore. What's his patience? You need, if you're going to resolve this issue, it's not going to be a one-hit shot, is it? It's going to be very extended. Does he have that sort of patience to handle? I mean, he doesn't have a background in the area. He's got very short in advisors. He's got America first, but nobody quite knows what that means, but maybe withdrawing troops and cutting the budget. But it just doesn't add up to me what he's going to achieve.
Well, I think you've probably analyzed it about right. I mean, it strikes me, as far as I can tell, that his primary interest is to see himself elevated at a global scale, to be seen as doing great things and being bold, et cetera, et cetera. Now, that's not entirely a bad thing. I'm not sure how much attention I really want him putting onto this very, very complex and difficult strategic challenge. But if, as President of the United States, he could at least reach an understanding with Kim that there is a pathway forward, that there is a legitimate and credible commitment on the part of the United States to engage seriously in dialogue with the North, and maybe with some sort of very vague over-the-horizon goals in mind, let's call it denuclearization, let's call it a peace treaty, etc., and then get out of the way and let his professional negotiators take it from there, then that's not a terrible outcome. My concern is that that's not going to be satisfying enough for his ego. And that's why I think you're probably right that he will only be satisfied going to Singapore and walking away with some grandiose announcement. But that announcement could be put in a set of phrases and phraseology, hopefully, that would be satisfying enough to him without overcommitting and sending the negotiation in very, very negative directions. Throw into all that, though, even if that sort of hopeful outcome could be the case, I think that there's very, very serious divisions within the Trump administration about whether or not that is the best outcome. I suspect that may be an outcome that someone like Pompeo or Mattis would like to see. I'm not so sure that a person like Bolton would want to see that, and might prefer either no summit or a summit that fails, and then puts us back on a path towards bloody noses and sanctions and the like.
Could I just come in with a thought on top of that? President Trump was famously quoted as saying that you can mask everything you need to know around ballistic missiles in 90 minutes. So that if that's a reflection of his attention to detail in briefing, you have to wonder what happens in the one-on-one situation when at that point those are the two principles and no amount of good staff work is going to potentially save Mr. Trump from being played against a consummate performer like Kim Jong-un. But here's a bit of speculation. Of course, North Korea is the refuge of scoundrels who like to speculate without fear of contradiction. But I suspect what Moon Jae-in has advised Kim Jong-un is go to that table on June the 12th, because this is your best opportunity. You won't get another one like it, because the longer it's left, the greater the chance that voices like John Bolton will work against the summit and that it will not be sustainable. So I suspect from the inter-Korean perspective, what Moon Jae-in wants to do is not really focus on details, transform the atmospherics in a way that will aid his inter-Korean narrative going forward, and that maybe not to worry so much about the details. What really, once that summit has taken place, it can't be reversed that the US president has met his North Korean counterpart. And I think from a South Korean perspective, that's something they're prepared to live with.
Even if it means Donald Trump winning a Nobel Prize.
Well, Moon Jae-in himself said he should.
I just wanted to take up one point that you raised was about lack of advice. but apparently before this fake news of Trump himself saying that the meeting was cancelled when, in fact, there was no intention of cancelling it, you mentioned that there is an advanced team in North Korea at the moment and that it seems that their preparations are happening and it's not just Donald and John Bolton involved.
That's right. There's a heavy-hitting team of national security, defence and State Department people who all got a lot of form in dealing with the North Koreans. I think part of the obvious risk of Secretary of State Pompeo taking nothing away from him, but if he's new in the job within a period of 3 weeks, he's dealing with people who've dealt with the US file for three decades or more. So I think there's a bit of ballast now in terms of the people who the US are actually putting in on the ground. They're not going to be easily fooled. But the unknown quantity is what happens in that one-on-one in the summit if Mr. Trump says, everybody leave the room, except the translators, he'll need the translators. What happens at that point? That's the fascinating part of it, is, you know, it is down to, in the end, a human interaction. Yes, but I mean, a win could just be something purely symbolic, as in, I declare the end of the Korean War, which doesn't mean too much, but it will get lots of headline space.
Gentlemen, just here.
Ian Kennedy is my name. From what I, as I hear it, the North Koreans are the winners already in this thing. He has got, Kim has got nothing but kudos, as it were, already. And almost whichever way it cuts in Singapore, should there be a Singapore, whether there is or not, he's scored points over Trump and the West, which he certainly wouldn't have had before, and the generations of his dynasty coming through to this point. Is that correct, do you think?
I think it's certainly Kim Jong-un gains more by the summit happening than any other than the opposite party. But there is a risk. The risk is maybe John Bolton isn't unhappy that the summit takes place if the summit then exposes the lack of faith, the problems of verification, the lying, the cheating on North Korea's part that then, to use his word, foreshortens the diplomatic process, and then we go back to maximum pressure, military options. Now, I think maximum pressure is going to be extremely difficult given the problem of enlisting South Korean support, let alone China, which I think would now be 10 times more difficult. But you still could face a situation when the United States faces a very real threat. And we talk about melodrama and theatrics, but those missile capabilities, as far as we know, are real. And they're untested, but we've seen the explosion. It was thermonuclear, more than likely. And those missiles have been extraordinarily successful given the limited means that Korea has. So that's not symbolism, that's not theatrics. And any sitting US president is going to have to deal with that one way or another. So that it's not without risk for Kim Jong-un, but Kim Jong-un has shown he's willing to assume risk, including flying all the way to Singapore to conduct this. So I think he thinks it's worth it on balance. But it's not all necessarily a rosy scenario for him.
Thank you. My name's Ian Crawford. I'm a guest of Jeffrey White. And I have a vested interest in the outcome of all this because I was a midshipman in the Korean War. And my grandson has been offered a peace camp in Korea in the near future. So I hope things can settle down a bit. But my question is there a bit of play acting going on? Is there a good cop, bad cop on the Allied side? Without specifying what the concessions could be, is there scope for one hardliner to make concessions to the other on the Allied side?
Meaning
that Moon Jae-in will make a lot of the progress to water down the hard line being taken by Trump.
I think that's what will happen. I mean, that's already the dynamic. I'm not convinced it's a strategy, that it's a concerted allied consultation and strategy that has got us to that point. It's, I think, just a sort of organic outcome, given that it is clearly in Moon Jae-in's interest to pursue the, as you put it, good cop approach, and it is President Trump's predilection to be a bad cop. So I think it's not really the outcome of strategy, but rather simply the dynamics of these particular personalities. That said, I mean, maybe it's going to it could well unfold in just about the right way, but I don't think we can count on it because, I mean, at some point the good cop bad cop routine has to resolve itself in a way that reaches the positive outcome you want. You can't just continue being a bad cop and expect the work of the good cop to continue to work.
I think the good cop bad cop is also worth interrogating of U.S. policy. I think we saw clear signs of that when President Trump, using on the one hand very belligerent language, belittling Kim Jong-un, but on the other saying the door was always open to a meeting and he would be honored to fulfill that role. And former Secretary of State Tillerson was also rapped on the knuckles for you know, pursuing negotiations with a man like Kim. And lo and behold, a few weeks later, we're in that space where President Trump is himself, and he alternates between bad cop and good cop. Maybe that's the problem. Is you can see that sort of tactical logic, but the logic is played out with such there's so little consistency in the messaging that I don't think it's it's fourth dimensional chess that we're seeing played out in Washington. It's much more likely to be the cock-up rather than the conspiracy. Certainly when it comes to the coordination between US and South Korea, we had President Moon apparently blindsided by the letter that Mr. Trump wrote last week, and despite having been in Washington just a few days previously, then arrived back and was told about this and called a meeting of his senior national security officials at midnight and declared himself baffled and very regretful. Well, if that's play acting, he deserves an Oscar.
One more question I think we've got time for.
If North Korea did open up economically, do you think it's inevitable that its citizens would leave? Or do you think there could be incentives? Or why? I'm interested in the enemy being within as opposed to without.
Let me just challenge you on that a little bit. You make the point that the case of North Korea and its opening economically probably wouldn't unfold in the same way as we've seen, say, in China, where as the state gathered strength, so too did its strength to monitor and surveil and even crack down even harder on its own people. But that wouldn't, you argue that wouldn't work as well in the Korean case because of the juxtaposition of the success of the South Korean state would become evident. Couldn't it be, though, that Kim could take a few pages out of the Xi Jinping playbook, and it may even be some things that Xi Jinping himself is offering up as some incentive, basically saying you can have economic growth and retain the security of the regime. Just look at me.
I think that's the lesson that China would clearly like Kim Jong-un to absorb. And I meant to say in further response to Richard McGregor's question that economic growth has been relatively healthy under Kim Jong-un. Things have changed. You know, there are a lot more buildings. Okay, it's concentrated in the capital, but trade has increased. We haven't seen any large-scale resort to imports of food in the way that was the case even 10 years ago. So, yes, there might be an element in which he's a greater risk-taker and he's prepared to take that risk. But I think there will be people around him who will be unnerved by that. And perhaps it's not the bottom-up, it's not the lowest quadrant of society that poses the threat. It's the people who are effectively the new middle class. And that's a tiger that Kim Jong-un has to keep on riding in the same way. She also has to keep riding that tiger, but it's a much more existential equation for Kim Jong-un. Because if he has to maintain enough resources flowing through that system to secure their loyalty, and I think that is much more difficult for him to do, given the narrative that North Korea has built up over all these years of the foreigners are to blame for everything, that sanctions are the reason why they're impoverished, that it's nothing to do with the failed command economy, that they have all these problems. And I think once you open up that Pandora's box, shine a light in it, if I was Kim Jong-un, I'd think very carefully about stepping down that road, because once you've opened up that economically, it's very hard to reverse those social reforms. So we'll see. You're right to ask the question, because we, especially if you look at the problem for long enough, you get hardwired and you tend to assume that nothing can ever change. But for me, North Korea is still structurally different to those other cases of communist reform.
And with that, thank you very much. We've reached 7 o'clock. Well, one thing can be sure, that June the 12th, if it happens, will be a complete pageant of fake tan, bleached hair and funny haircuts, and an absolute feast for the photographers, almost to rival the royal wedding. So that bit I'm looking forward to. Thank you very much, Bates. Thank you very much, Ewan. Thank you.